The Heaven Field, a novel by I.G. Hume, read by the author. Episode 8, Phantoms. Alex sat in the semi-darkness of the shabby room, a suitcase open before him on the bed. Room 13 was at the far end of a grubby hallway on the first floor, overlooking an unkempt park. He'd had no trouble from the youth at reception, who seemed unconcerned as to who frequented the rooms. Alex rubbed his sore ankle absent-mindedly. He ached all over from the exertions of the previous night, and his clothes were dishevelled and torn. He got up from the bed and slowly limped over to the small ensuite bathroom, where he poured himself a glass of water. He took a long look at himself in the mirror. His face was grimy and unshaven, and his greying hair stuck up in a mess. Taking off his shirt with a slow, painful action, he scrubbed himself clean in the icy water. Feeling a little more refreshed, Alex returned to the bed and the contents of the suitcase. There was a collection of Drago's clothes, all of them far too small for Alex, a wash bag, and a small Bible. Placing the Bible to one side, he emptied the suitcase onto the floor. There, at the bottom of the case, was a bulky satellite phone. He picked it up and inspected it cautiously. Upon switching it on, the screen prompted him for a PIN number. Alex sighed and turned to the Bible on the bed, thumbing idly through the pages. He wasn't sure where the number would be concealed, but he knew he would recognize it when he came upon it. A shout from outside made him look up in alarm. He moved quickly over to the window, pulling back the curtain a little. A woman was calling to her dog on the muddy grass opposite. Alex followed her with his eyes until she was out of sight, then went back to the bed.
"Come on, Drago, give me a clue," he muttered quietly to himself, as he flicked through the small book, which was delicately bound in purple cloth and gold leaf. 10 minutes later, he had found it. Ezekiel, chapter 1, verse 4, was underlined in faint pencil. He scanned through the rest of the chapter. 2 more verses were each highlighted. He noted down the numbers as he went, until he was left with 5 digits. Picking up the phone, he slowly tapped in the numbers, holding his breath as he got to the last one. It was standard procedure for these phones to be packed with explosive, rigged to go off if the wrong number was entered. His finger hovered over the final key for a second, and his heart missed a beat. He shut his eyes and pressed the button. A welcome sign flashed up on the screen. He sighed with relief and pressed redial. An international number came up and started ringing.
"Welcome. This is the voicemail service for Safe Home Security. Please leave a message after the tone."
"This is Alexei, 180371. I might be the only one left. I'm in trouble. Get back to me."
He hung up and went back to the bathroom to wash the cut on his knee. A shrill ring from the phone and Alex burst back into the room.
"Hello?"
he called breathlessly.
"Alexei, is that you?"
came a crackly, distant voice.
"Paola?" "Oh, we feared the worst, Alexei. What has happened?" "The people we dealt with, they've set us up. We've lost everybody, and they're after me. I need to get out of the country." "Paola, they may know your location." "Look, Alexei, just sit tight and we'll get you out." "What do you mean, sit tight? I just need some new ID and someone to meet up with." "Alexei, you've been posted all over the international press. They're searching for you in connection with some plane crash. They've got security camera pictures of you all over the news stations. Just stay where you are and we'll come to you. We're redirecting the Lambert team. They'll pick you up on the way back."
"What are you talking about?" asked Alex in disbelief.
"That's madness. How are you going to get me into the field without an array?"
"We've checked your level of exposure to the field," said Paola solemnly. "They think they can shift you straight in. You're on the border now, Alexei."
Alex felt a sudden shock of horror.
I can get myself back home," he stammered. I just need..."
"Listen to me, Alexei. We need everybody back now."
There was a long silence.
"It started, Alexei. It's finally begun."
"What shall I do?" he croaked.
They'll be there in just under 6 hours. Can you stay in the same place for that long? You're in the hotel, aren't you?
Yes, I should be okay. It's as good a place as any.
Are you tracking the phone?
Yes, we can send the team those coordinates. Just stay concealed. They'll get to you.
God be with you, Alexei. Alex paced the room anxiously, muttering nervously to himself.
It's finally begun,
he repeated over and over again.
Guterich stared down idly at the sprinkling of red dust covering the carpet, prodding at it with his toe.
It looks like he left quite recently, said the policeman. We found his clothes in the bathroom. The mud on them is still wet. Shall I get a forensics team in here?
No, there is no need, grunted Guterich. Could you give us a moment, please, officer?
Sure, I'll just be outside if you need me.
So, drawled Guterich, turning to the young man from reception, who was standing nervously between two of Gutteridge's colleagues. What's your story?
I just saw him, you know, the guy on the telly, like, stuttered the youth. It was him, wasn't it? The guy from the plane crash. He looked beat up, like, is there a reward or something?
And you say he checked in at 9:30 a.m. And you called the police at, let me see here, 5:06 p.m. Is that right? Said the squat man wearily.
Yeah, sure. So is there a reward or what?
And you didn't see him leave?
I told the other guy I didn't see him since he checked in.
Okay, Griel. Show him out. One of the men led the youth out of the room, as he still babbled on about a reward.
Guterich took out a mobile phone and dialed a number.
Yes, sir. Yes, it's Guterich, sir. I'm afraid he's gone, sir. No, they picked him up somehow. We found his clothes. Yes, sir. They've taken him into the field.
Spears slammed the phone down with a curse. He sat deep in thought for a moment, and then leaned forward and took a large cigar from the carved wooden box on his desk. He sighed to himself and pressed a button on his phone.
Miss Davis, put me a secure line through to the White House. Ed Thomas, would you?
Certainly, Mr. Spears, came the reply.
Ah, George, what's the news? Everything went as planned, I trust? Came a slow, calculating drawl. It's ongoing, replied Spears, with a faint hint of nervousness in his voice. We just need to...
Don't tell me you screw it up, George, because I don't want to hear it. Now what happened? Have you found where those bastards are hiding yet?
It is on the way, sir, replied Spears. I am confident our operative Monsworth can...
Monsworth? You should have taken care of that place by now. Monsworth shouldn't be there, Spears. I should be expressing my deepest sympathy at such a terrible catastrophe. That was our one chance, George.
Things haven't gone fully to plan, sir, but I can assure you that we shall have the facility shut down by the end of the month.
We still have leverage.
You mean the plane crash?
Goddamn, Spears, I don't know why I ever let you talk me into this.
Will it be enough to close them down?
I'm positive we can make it so, sir.
As I always say, if force doesn't work, there's always politics.
Don't get wise, Spears. That's a much deadlier game to play in this situation.
I don't know. I'm getting cold feet about this whole goddamn affair.
Sir, whether you like it or not, we are at war. And we don't have an army that can cope with the enemy. If we don't have complete military control over the field, then we have no national security. We are close to replicating the British technology. Once we have access to the field, we can neutralize these threats before it's too late.
Okay, okay. But if any of this gets out, George, we are in serious shit.
I understand that, sir. Believe me, nothing will get out.
I'm preparing the information now. Monsworth will not be a problem.
You better be right on this, George. The phone went dead.
Spears lit his cigar and sat back in his leather armchair. He was walking a tightrope with this one, and it was a long way down if he fell.
I didn't think I'd ever be quite so relieved to be back in the field, breathed Alex as he trudged along with his three companions.
You'll soon get sick of it again, laughed Peter grimly as he followed along behind them.
Alex moved slowly. His limbs were aching terribly, and with the added weight of the huge environment suit, he didn't know how far he could manage.
Is it much further? He gasped.
A couple of 100 meters, said Peter encouragingly.
You're getting old, Alexei, came a voice from behind him.
It was Ekristina. Her voice was light with laughter.
It's been a busy few days, Chris, sighed Alex, stopping and shifting the weight off his ankle.
It was throbbing again under the extra load. He sat down and looked around him. He hadn't seen such an unspoiled area of the field in a long time.
It's good to remember what we're fighting for, isn't it?
Said Ekristina, stopping by Alex's side. They were standing in a shallow open valley, the two sides rising up in high outcrops of smooth stones, carved by the wind into exquisite sculptural forms. The floor of the valley was carpeted in soft, vibrant grass, sprinkled with delicate white and yellow flowers. The valley swept out before them, dipping down to a great plain of tall, lush grasses. Far in the distance, a huge column of dust clouds rose miles into the clear blue sky.
Is all that because of me?
Asked Alex, staring up at the clouds, knowing the destruction they signified.
It was necessary, Alexei, sighed Peter.
Alex stayed silent, mesmerized by the terrible storm. He thought of Patty once more. She had been so trusting. He felt sick to his stomach.
So, who's the young babbler? He asked brightly, trying to take his mind off things.
He nodded to the other figure that stood with them. Alex couldn't make out his face behind the dusty visor.
Yuri, sir, Yuri Antonov, came a nervous, high-pitched voice. It is an honour to meet you, sir.
An honour? Is he for real?
Muttered Alex, turning to Peter and Chris.
You'd better get used to it, Alexei. You're something of a hero back at home, laughed Ekristina.
Alex stared at her with a baffled expression.
You've done some special things, Alexei, said Peter solemnly. You were there from the beginning.
Have I been away so long? Sighed Alex sarcastically. Have you all gone soppy since I was last home?
Oh, well, Yuri, lend an old legend your arm to lean on and we can get going.
Yuri came forward nervously and helped him to his feet.
Are you injured? I didn't realize, asked Chris in concern. Just bumps and bruises, replied Alex, wincing a little. I fell on my ankle. It's just given me a bit of pain.
Don't worry. It's not far now, said Peter, as they walked slowly across the valley floor.
Grace sat across the small table from Davison, the sun streaming in through the open window. They sat in an uncomfortable silence, Davison staring out across the dark moorland. The room was quite cheerful, thought Grace, though hospitals always made her uneasy. She coughed quietly and tried to resume their awkward conversation.
So, you don't think the apparitions were real, then?
Davison shuffled uncomfortably and looked annoyed.
I told you already, they weren't real. We've already had this out.
He was frustrated and distant. Grace couldn't forget the way he had recoiled from her when she had gone to hug him, and she had known him for almost 20 years.
But you all saw the same things, she said, pressing again. Do you think it was all some sort of shared hallucination?
In one swift movement, Davison banged his fist down upon the table. The jug of water jumped, and the ice tinkled in agitation.
Look, you still don't get it, do you?
He hissed. Grace shrank back from him. She had never heard such anger in his voice. His eyes stared straight into her, and she had to turn her face away. "You just don't get it." His voice was quiet now, and leaden. "None of you are real. You're all ghosts." He went back to staring bleakly out of the window. "None of you are real," he whispered, and would say no more.
"That's your transport?" gasped Alex, as he rounded the last outcrop of rock. "You came all the way in that?"
Parked beneath an overhang of rock was a large tracked vehicle the size of a small lorry, its bulky metal-plated sides covered in the same thick red corrosion as their suits. It looked as if it had been dredged up from the bottom of the sea.
"It's all cosmetic," laughed Peter. "She's as solid as a rock under that mess."
"I hope so," said Alex.
"I don't want to walk any further than I have to."
His ankle throbbed painfully whenever it touched the ground. They reached the rear of the vehicle, and the back slowly lowered to form a ramp for them to ascend. They all huddled in the small airlock as the door closed slowly behind them. There was a short hiss of gas, then the inner hatch clicked open. "You can remove your helmet now," said Chris to Alexei, as she lifted off her own. She ducked through the doorway, and Alex followed her into the living compartment. Two bunks on either wall were folded down to make a seating area, and Alex noted two bunks above these, folded back against the walls. The compartment was cramped, and full of equipment stowed away in every available space. A feeble light came in through small oval windows in the walls. Yuri passed Alex on his way to the other end of the compartment, giving him a nervous glance. He looked no more than a boy, 17 at most. Yet already he had that familiar look in his eye. He had seen such things as most would never witness in a lifetime, thought Alex sadly.
Are you from Russia then, Yuri? Asked Alex.
Georgia. I was in the Russian army.
He looked down in shame.
I deserted, he said quietly.
He tried to meet Alex's gaze, but had to turn away.
I must get to the observation blister.
His voice tailed off, and he disappeared hurriedly through the far hatch.
Sorry, muttered Alex to himself.
Don't worry, smiled Chris, as she removed her suit and stowed it in a locker below her bunk. He's a good kind, just a little nervous. Alex watched her as he started to remove his own suit. Ekristina was an athletic, powerful woman, with a striking face and a stern jawline. Her long dark hair fell free as she clambered into a set of khaki overalls. Next to her was Peter. He tossed Alex a similar set of overalls.
These should fit okay, Alexei, though I'm afraid we don't have a spare bed. You'll have to sleep outside.
He laughed deeply as he pulled on his clothes. He was also tall and powerful, with thick black curly hair and beard, and an infectious smile.
I suppose you'll want me to clean the windows while I'm out there, will you? Retorted Alex.
He pulled on his overalls. They were huge on him, and he had to roll the trousers up.
Well, make yourself comfortable, grinned Chris. It's going to be a long ride.
How long will it take to get back? Asked Alex, sitting himself down on a bunk. About 2 weeks, maybe 10 days, if we don't hit too much trouble, shrugged Peter, and disappeared through the hatch at the far end of the compartment. There's some food in the locker by your feet and water over there, said Chris, following Peter through the hatch.
Save us a little, though. We'll be on short rations now, she grinned.
Chris, said Alex somberly, thanks again for picking me up. I was in big trouble back there with Drago.
He trailed off, looking downcast.
Get some rest, Alexei, said Chris tenderly. We're not out of danger yet.
Grace walked slowly through the low clutter of buildings, making her way from the infirmary back towards the facility entrance. God, she was sick of being on this base. For the past week, since the rescue, there had been such a feeling of despair looming over all their work. Nobody trusted anybody else. Her mind hurt from trying to remember which story she had to tell to which person, and nobody knew if the future of the project was doomed anyway. The array was fully repaired and checked. Grace had made sure that work still went on there. And Jim Grayson was still in charge of control. He was a godsend when it came to boosting morale. But security was driving everyone crazy, and there wasn't a hope in hell of getting back into the field before a full inquiry and investigation was underway. Everybody was being interrogated. She'd spent endless hours over the last week answering questions and having to justify her actions. The whole place was under virtual lockdown. No weekend passes, everybody getting cabin fever, shut away underground with nothing to do but worry about the future. And her last hospital visit to Saul Davison wasn't helping. She remembered him as such a stolid, untouchable man. A true scientist explorer, calm and deliberate. Nothing ever seemed to faze him, even Grace in one of her argumentative moods. Now he looked like an empty husk. Gary Starling was doing the best out of all of them. They'd managed to piece together most of what had happened from him. The fragments the others had given her corroborated his story, far-fetched and fantastical as it sounded. He appeared to cope with his experiences only because of his refusal to accept them as real. "The next hallucination we came upon was a woman," he would say in an unemotional tone. It was as if he were reading a police report. But in his eyes there was a look of hysteria, and he still didn't sleep at nights. O'Keefe was pretty bad. He was on some heavy medication, and his wife couldn't understand why he screamed when their children were in the room. And Nix. It had been touch and go as to whether he'd make it, but he'd regained consciousness, and they said he was improving slowly. Grace made her way back down to the basement, as she called the labs. "How are they doing?" asked Jane Honeyman as Grace entered control. "Looking good. They're all well on the road to recovery," she lied badly. Everyone she saw asked after them, unable to understand why they weren't allowed access to their colleagues. Grace gave some vague lies to each of them. Eventually she made it to her office and closed the door behind her. She burst into tears, sobbing in great uncontrollable coughs. Her weeping died away after a while, and wiping her nose on her sleeve, she went to her desk drawer and pulled out a bottle of red wine. 94, a good year, she smiled to herself, and hunted around for a polystyrene cup. She sighed and filled it to the brim, then glancing up, saw Thomas Sullivan hurry past her office window. He was the only person in this whole incestuous facility who was neutral, she thought. He didn't have a clue as to what was going on, and as yet no one was allowed to let him in on it. Besides, she felt sorry for him in a way. He was probably a bright lad, just painfully shy, and she still hadn't got round to finding him a job. Thomas! She yelled down the corridor. A black clump of tangled hair popped back around the corner. What are you up to? She shouted. Not much, he stammered, walking nervously back to her. Grace noticed with a smile that Saunders seemed to have let him off his leash for a change. Jane, that is, Miss Honeyman, asked me to post some letters for her. And have you finished that task she set for you? She asked, trying to suppress a smirk. She really must find out what he was good at, she thought. He'd been turned into the general dog's body. She just hadn't had the time to find him a proper job. Yes, Miss, Dr. Palmer, he replied. Oh, for goodness sake, my name's Grace. Now, Thomas, I have another job for you. Step into my office. He followed her into the office and she pointed to a chair by the desk. He sat down nervously in silence. What would you like me to do? He mumbled, scrutinising the back of his hands. You're to sit there and drink some wine with me, she replied, pouring another cupful. I don't really drink, that is. Everybody drinks, she said absently, slumping into her seat. She lit a cigarette and took a gulp of wine. She leaned back in her chair, taking a long look at him. With a wry smile, she said, Now, what shall we talk about?
Jesus, have you ever seen anything like that? Whispered one of the coroner's assistants through his mask.
He checked himself and looked away embarrassed, remembering suddenly that the base commander was standing beside him.
I'm sorry, sir,
he mumbled, but James didn't hear him. He was lost in thought, peering intently through the glass windows. The treatment room of the infirmary had been hastily set up as a mortuary. Patty's cadaver was laid out on a metal table, with members of the coroner's staff looking on. They had been attempting an autopsy on the remains for the past 4 hours. One of the robed figures left the room through the door next to James.
Margaret, he called, following her as she went.
Margaret, how are you getting on?
I was wondering if you had found anything out yet.
It really is too early, Commander, sighed the woman, stopping and removing her mask.
We've only just begun here. It's going to take time. A lot of analysis, tests. There's not much left to work on.
But the way she looks, what do you think could have caused it? Asked James anxiously.
Look, I just don't have any idea right now, she said in frustration, starting to lose her temper. It's chaos here. I've got mystery corpses, the bits of those two boys they scraped off the walls. I'm not allowed to observe even basic procedure about notifying the proper authorities. I'm going out on a limb for you here, and it's all getting too much.
Look, I'm sorry, Margaret. I realise you are sticking your neck out, and I'm truly grateful. Really, I am.
Margaret seemed to calm down a little.
If there's anything you need, any help, just let me know, said James.
Just give me some more time, she said quietly. I should have got to see her much sooner, then it might have been easier.
She turned to go, and then stopped, looking back at him with a sigh.
Okay, for what it's worth, I haven't got the faintest idea what killed that girl, said Margaret wearily. Maybe some exposure to a chemical or corrosive agent, I just don't know. It doesn't seem to be anything biological. I don't think we've got an outbreak of some crazy virus on our hands. But other than that, it's like nothing I've ever seen before.
Sorry. She turned and disappeared down the corridor, leaving James standing alone amongst the bustle of hospital staff. Gutteridge calmly watched the base commander finish his conversation with the coroner. After a few moments, the large man strode off towards the infirmary exit. Gutteridge finished unloading the boxes and medical equipment and walked back towards the treatment rooms.
Hey, you! Came a voice from behind him.
He nonchalantly turned around to see a uniformed security guard approaching him.
Me?
He asked innocently.
You don't have clearance to be in there, grunted the guard, nodding towards the treatment rooms. I'll get someone to take their supplies in for you.
Well, that makes my job easier, smiled Gutteridge easily. I just need somebody to sign this. Then I can get going. He held out a clipboard to the guard.
Yeah, I'll do that, he said, taking the board and signing it.
That's great, smiled Gutteridge. Just make sure you get those boxes moved. Some of them need refrigerating. Bye then. He left the soldier grumbling to himself and walked the harshly lit corridor back towards the exit, showing his identity card once again as he left. He approached the ambulance he had arrived in and glanced up at the driver, who gave him a barely noticeable nod. Gutteridge calmly stopped and knelt down to tie his shoelace, surreptitiously glancing around to see if anyone was watching. It was getting dark, and the few military personnel in view were looking the other way. He slipped into the shadows, down the side of the infirmary building. He moved smoothly and quietly for a man of his build. He stopped and stiffened as he heard someone breathe in the darkness next to him.
Gutteridge,
came a nervous whisper.
Hello, miss,
he replied in a self-assured tone.
This is too much, hissed the woman. You're asking too much this time. If I'd have known what was going to happen before, I would never agree to it.
Save it, drawled Gutteridge idly. I'm just the messenger boy. Here, take it, he said, holding out a padded envelope.
You know what to do with it. Are you sure you can get the necessary access?
Yes, I think so,
she whispered forlornly as she took the package.
At least this will end without bloodshed, she sighed.
Don't get soft on me now, he smiled. We're counting on you.
With that, he turned and made his way back to the ambulance. He climbed into the passenger seat, and the vehicle drove off towards the main gates.
He You have been listening to The Heaven Field. For more information, downloads, and artwork, visit theheavenfield.com.